Welcome to Conscious Communication, the podcast that can help you improve your company's culture and better your team's communication, helping you build more significant relationships. Now here's your host, Philip Bogolub.
I have the honor and privilege of talking with Dr. Carla Fowler. She is an MD and a PhD and an elite executive coach. She is the founder and managing director of FAXA. I think I got that right. And I just have to put this little note on because I did a lot of research about her and stuff. And one of the things I saw was she was a badass doctor, but now she went from that to be a performance coach. I just love this stuff. So, and she refers to herself as the secret weapon for all sorts of people. And when I read that, I thought, James Bond, 007. So she's the James Bond of elite coaching. And I don't want to get her mad because she might have one of those laser things that, you know, on the watches or something that James Bond had. But I love that stuff because the secret weapon, that's a secret sauce. I like that stuff. So she combines performance science and best practices and the bringing out the best in people. And I love that. And I want to thank you for being on the show today.
Philip, thanks so much for having me. I'm just chuckling about the, I wish I had a Q. You know, the character, like,
oh, of course,
to get me all the great technology. And I'm often using new technologies in my practice. So I'm actually going to start referring to, you know, my most latest virtual whiteboard that I'm using to coach with people. I feel like I need to be like, oh, yeah, I got this from Q. Just
you're right. And those of you who don't watch James Bond, he's like the quality guy or he's the scientific.
He's the techie, like he designs all the
gadgets.
Yeah, like the save your life in a watch or the ejection parachute in the cool car.
Yes.
That was all Q is my recollection.
Yeah, I got the little button that I could do. Boom, somebody flies out of the car. And he always, James Bond, always got down to the thing. And then it's like a little saw comes out and tears the straps away from his hand that he's tied into. I love all that stuff. So back to this. You're not a Seinfeld fan, are you?
I was not. No. Mostly, I may have missed it a little bit. I didn't have a TV in college. And so that held me back.
Now she's making real, I'm really old. I don't remember Seinfeld. Oh, no, I'm just kidding. Now you don't even need a TV in college anymore. You just need your phone. Yeah. So I want to start the conversation off with, what was the serendipity in your life? What was the coincidence? What was that accident that brought you to where you are today? You didn't just wake up one day and go, huh, I think I want to be an MD, an elite coach, and get a PhD. So what was that little turn that guided you in that direction where you are who you are today?
I think there's a bunch of them. There was obviously one big pivot moment when I was in my general surgery residency program at Stanford and was like, this is not the right fit. I'm going to need to make a pivot. But like long before that, I think I was following little moments of serendipity and kind of following stuff I was interested in. Not totally impractical. Like I had sort of figured out that I really liked doing stuff that was hard and figuring out how to do it. So that started like as early as fifth grade, like the presidential physical fitness test.
Oh, yeah.
This was a thing you had to do.
Yeah, I remember that.
For a certificate signed by the president. And there was one event I couldn't sort it. And I really wanted to get the patch and the award. And so I went up to the elementary school and started practicing the shuttle run. Like of my own volition, I just went up.
Wait,
there.
What was the shuttle run? I don't remember that.
Like back and forth between two cones.
Oh.
In a certain amount of time.
Right. All right. I remember that. Yes.
But I had these great teachers, these people who like influenced me along the way. Like in middle school, I had this teacher and she was one tough cookie. And she had this alternative outdoor class where she made us do these really difficult physical challenges. Like she had us walk around Lake Washington, which is just outside the Seattle area, in 24 hours. And what that amounted to was 55 miles, like about 50 seventh and eighth graders did it. So we were like 12 or 13 year olds.
Wow.
And we would take breaks. We just kept walking. And You know, you start in the dark, you finish in the dark. It takes about 24 hours.
It really was 24 hours.
Yes. And
since we're doing this,
like 40 or 50 of us, it was it was required to pass the class.
Wild. I have heard of that. Okay.
What's great is that was just one of the things. There were about 12 other ridiculous physical challenges that we don't need to go into. But I mean, we all had to train for a half marathon. There was a day where we ran to Tacoma. So we ran 29 miles in one day as, you know, 12 and 13 year olds. But I like, these are some of the moments going along where I was like, well, I like to know how to do challenging things because it makes me feel more capable. And also, I have this sense that if you're, you know, I hadn't even begun to think about like, what do you want to do for work? I just knew you needed work. And that probably if you knew how to do hard things, like, and could figure it out, that you would be able to find someone who would value that and you would be able to have a job. I mean, I think this was my very, you know, my middle school perception of how do you get prepared for life?
Right.
You're not gonna live with your parents forever. And
no. No. So it's a good way to, it's a good mindset at an early age. It still works.
It works. It was a reasonable, let's just say like a heuristic at that age of do stuff you're interested in so that you're not, you know, bored out of your mind or just totally unmotivated. Like you get some of that natural clean energy that that fuels you.
Yep.
And then, you know, it's not a perfect proxy, but if you can do things that are difficult and you know how to get yourself to sort it, then probably you can deal with some of the uncertainty that will come later. And, you know, that there's, we need that in our workplaces. So it was a reasonable heuristic, albeit not super focused.
That's okay, because it was a challenge to you, because what I like about what I do, and we talked before I hit the record button, I was an engineer in the medical field. And what I really loved about it is somebody called me to come in and troubleshoot and help something called an x-ray tube. And I've mentioned it to our listeners before. And it's an important medical device, but I didn't come in there like, you know, okay, do this, do that. The person just needed somebody to talk to. And I like troubleshooting. And it's for a lot of people, and it's nothing wrong with this, it's uncomfortable. For me, I loved it. I was like, I had to go somewhere last minute, or I had to go do something with it, whatever it was. And, you know, doctors are yelling and there's all this they had to do, you know, imaging, blah, blah. But this was my forte. And I knew how to deal with it. And I like that. It's like when I prepare for this interview or any interview, I get kind of the heart going and I do the, I don't do questions till like maybe a half hour before it starts because I want spontaneity. And a lot of times I don't even use all the questions, but I like that. And that uncomfortableness, that unknown, that unused folder, the thing that you've not used before is enlightening to me because it gives you new hope, which gives you options. And it's just very cool to see that. And you had that. So when did you decide that you were going to go into the medical stuff? You're going to be a medical doctor.
I figured that out about 1 year into college. So I also started as an engineer and I loved math and science. Total nerd. But again, like math and science are things that you can sort of figure out. There's a process to it. And later in life, I now understand a little more about what is the problem solving of how one explores literature or history or how one does that thinking. But I'll be honest, at the time, I was like, I don't know how these things work, but math and science are my jam.
Okay.
And so I went off to a university where there were no core requirements, so I could take all math and science. And I started in engineering. Yep. And engineering seemed like a good place to start. There, you know, it was a place where, again, already kind of some of the STEM efforts of getting more women involved were, I think, present. And so it was helpful for admissions. And so I did a year of that. And then I figured out that it wasn't quite human enough for me. So I ended up being a first aid supporter at a camp. That was my summer job after that first year. And I was like, learning from this nurse. And I was like, oh, medicine. This is super interesting. Like it was that thing that added that just sort of energy to doing the problem solving. Like I really wanted to help people. And I was like, that's how I can combine these things. And then a moment of serendipity was I actually took an immunology class as part of my undergraduate and had the most fabulous teacher. And the thing about the immune system, and this is actually what I ultimately went on to get my PhD in, is that it is, I guess we're all more familiar with just how complex and sort of interesting it is post-COVID. We all learned more about the immune system than any of us perhaps anticipated. But it is fascinating. And I had this teacher who really put extra effort into saying, how can you create interesting puzzles for people to solve, not just fact-based tests? And so I think that was a moment of serendipity of just looking at it and saying, this is going to be the future. This was in 19, probably 99, but I was already looking at it and saying, oh, the number of like therapeutics, diagnostics, and things that we will build from this technology, it's going to be huge. And of course, that is the case.
Yeah. So, when I first got into the business, I'm a little older than you. And it was in 1985 when I got out of college, got my first job, and I was installing CAT scanners, computerized tomography. And well, she knows, I'm just telling my audience again, it's not for cats, it's for humans. And it took about 3 or 4 months to install.
Yeah.
Now it takes like 3 days.
Right.
But but the amazing part is, I mean, I was there for, you know, I saw things, you know, CDs, they had laser discs in the medical field first.
Yes.
The things were this giant. Oh, you remember those?
Oh, yeah.
It looked like a giant floppy, those hardcover floppies, and you put it in and you could only get the images onto one side, and that was it. And it worked forever. And then I got trained on laser cameras. And so a lot of things in the real world came out of the medical world first.
Yeah.
And it's very cool. And I worked at the University of Chicago for a few years in-house, and I learned so much by asking questions and seeing things. And, you know, it's like, hey, doc, you don't want me to fix that? I was in surgical suites and stuff. But I always found it interesting because, you know, like we talked about before, the record button was, I learn more from listening than talking. I don't learn anything from my voice. I just get a sore voice. I learn from listening and looking and going, I didn't think of it that way. Oh, I didn't think of it. I mean, just seeing those little things that happen in your life and going back, because I believe all people have a purpose. And if they look at that and take themselves out of what's happening at that moment, and they realize their inner knowing knows, their soul knowledge, they really know what they are, what makes them breathe, what makes them happy, what makes them abundant and joyful. They know, but they don't, they're kind of scared. It's like, how is that something as a coach, how do you teach somebody that, I'm sure you've taught people that maybe you saw they might be in the wrong place. How do you kind of turn them on to what their purpose is or kind of get them on track and make them focus a little bit better as a coach? And knowing the physiology, because you'll totally understand this. What we think eventually becomes out in our physical being.
And it's not mind and body. I mean, like it's one bucket.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
Everything interacts. Yeah. It's not physical health and mental health. Like very clearly, like what is happening in much of our physiology that is below the neck is absolutely impacting like what's happening like in our brains and vice versa, right? Like we know that, for example, when something's not totally right in our brains, that will have big impacts on, you know, pieces of our body below the neck. But when I think you're asking about how do you help people sort of find whether it's like their direction, like the thing that really lights them up, how do you help them get clarity on that? Or even they're in the thing, but they're not feeling confident about it. There's something that's a little off. So that's a different flavor. How do you do that? Well, as a coach, one of the things I have found is really useful, and this is something I do that's a little different than many coaches, is I start every coaching engagement by really emphasizing getting some clarity. And I can talk a little more about what I mean. I call this brutal focus because often it's more time than anyone has really ever spent thinking about themselves, what they want, and what is most important for them. And it's brutal because sometimes the stuff we realize is like, oh, I need to be doing things really differently than what I'm seeing happening around me, than what my colleagues or my peers are doing. So it is a level above generally how we normally live. And that's why I call it brutal. Not because it has to be painful, but because it will feel really different. And that can be a little uncomfortable.
It's uncomfortable. Right, right.
Exactly.
Okay. So really, how do you, because I find when you give people homework, they don't necessarily do it. In the corporate world, we went to these classes and they were okay, but they were kind of hokey. You know, well, here's a book, read this, do some stuff. You go home, you put it on your next to your bed, you sit there for the next time you start dusting and it's there 6 months later, you throw it in the garbage. How do you activate something in someone that can be not just relevant when you're coaching them at that moment in time, mm-hmm. but something they can carry along with them after you're not coaching them anymore?
Yes. There are two places I think this comes from. And one is sometimes we start with a new perspective. Sometimes you can kind of flip a light switch for somebody when you express something to them, like a really different way of thinking about something. And this is a beautiful thing. Sometimes our friends do it for us. As a coach, that's often a normal piece of the job description is to say, have really different perspectives. But sometimes we start with a perspective or a mindset shift that then has very lasting impacts. And in fact, that's the research on mindsets, everything from like having a growth mindset to even having a mindset of I belong here is another really interesting area of research around mindsets, that there are interventions we can do on mindset that have lasting, even if people don't remember the intervention that or the class or the workshop they went through. If it targets mindset, that can have very lasting effects outside. Okay, so that's one direction.
Okay.
Perspective or mindset changes, and then suddenly we're doing really different stuff because we're like, because I can do that, or because I see I could enjoy it, or I belong here. And so, of course, I'm going to go do the stuff that it is to be here. But I think it can go the other direction too. And so sometimes, like, no amount of talking is going to have someone like have the right shift of mindset. And that's where I find it super useful to focus on behavior, because sometimes our mindset shifts because we can look back and say, well, gosh, I've been running for the past 5 months. I guess I'm a runner. I guess I can do this. Like, and so what you can focus on is not, do you think you're a runner? Or do you think you're not a runner? But to say, well, what would it look like to get started? And like a tool that I love, this is just one of many ways to talk about it, but like 90-90-90, which is you talk to people about like, hey, you know what? 90% of people never get started on the thing. Like you might think getting started is not that big a deal, but getting started is a big deal. And 90% of people don't keep going. And so even if you're not improving anything about what you're doing, just keep going. Just keep like lacing up the shoes, get out the door. And like, and then the final 90 is like 90% of the people who are left don't ever then think later on about like, well, could I improve this? Like if I wanted to train for something a little longer, what might I change or iterate or alter? And it would be okay to do that. Like it would be okay to run some little experiments. So sometimes I just focus on not thinking too hard about like the why or the emotions around it or like all the stuff, and just say, well, let's just focus on the physical action of what it is that you want to do and how you could get started. And then we can think about like, how could we just help you keep going on that? Are there structures or ways to sort of make sure it's always on your calendar or have some accountability with it or, you know, and so sometimes we just focus on getting a behavior going and saying, let's not worry too much about anything philosophical about it. And later, they're like, man, I've been doing this for a while. Now I have a mindset shift about what that means about me in a positive way. And so those are two ways to think about, like, as a coach. And I love having options because every person's different. And as a scientist, you find what works.
And that doesn't mean it's the only way that works. And, you know, you have to adapt. Wife and I started, we joined the health club in several years ago, and I swear I forgot how to swim. I swear. I mean, just, you know, like the, what do they call it? The crawl or whatever they call it.
Yeah.
And we couldn't even do a lap. And now I'm to the point, I'm not an Olympic swimmer, but I get in the pool, it's my time. I go off in my, on my Agenoi, I go off in my world and I just imagine my day and I thank everything for everything I have, my hands, my feet. And then I think about my day and I think about the joys. I don't think about what I don't have. I think about what I do have.
Yeah.
I think about the positivity, not the negativity. And the more you keep doing it, you're talking about behaviors. And then the next thing I'm knowing, my wife's like, you know, I don't count. She's counting. She's an actuary. So she counts everything. So she says, well, I did 2022. You must have done more. I go, I gave up counting. I in that zone, I mean, I don't flip or anything. I'm not fancy. But it's just the idea that it's, you're talking about mind and body and mind. It is one thing. And it's, I love that idea because you're right. It really isn't separate. It's all one unit. And one affects the other in whatever way we're doing it. Because when we get really aggravated with life and we think that we're lost, you stub your toe, you're arguing with your wife, your girlfriend, your boyfriend, your family, you're angry, you're beeping the horn in the car, you can't sleep in the middle of the night. And you're giving tools to be able to weed through those, ask those questions, mark things down. Do you find, she has a really cool thing behind her. It's a whiteboard. And we had the discussion earlier about getting a good whiteboard. Because we like the same thing as, and you've got to write it down first. Do you find, I do for myself, but I want to know what you think about this, pencil to paper. When, you know, we've got 9 million random thoughts going through our mind all the time. And if you don't put something pencil to paper, do you think it makes a difference when you write things down for your goals, your objectives and things? How do you feel about that whole writing stuff?
I feel good about it. I also know that one of the challenges we get into with performance sometimes is we start to think that there's like this perfect way you have to do something, like journaling, for example. I think a number of people may not have done journaling or stuck with journaling. Meditation is the same because we think we're doing it wrong and that there's like this magic thing that's supposed to happen if we're doing it right. And so one of the things I also do is I like to be a total myth buster about performance. I like to think about it scientifically and say, what's actually most important about this thing we're doing? And get people away from, oh, there must be this proper way to do it and I'm not doing it right. So I'm probably not getting the benefits. So this point about writing things down. And what I would say is absolutely, it is a useful tool. And in my world as a coach, I also know that sometimes we start to write things down on our own. And then, I don't know, we start judging what we wrote on the page and all of that. So part of what I do as a coach is, for example, when I start working with someone, this goes back a little bit to your earlier question, you know, how do you help someone get some of that clarity? I spend 5 hours with them. We take some breaks. People are like, that sounds epically long, but it actually flies by. And part of it is, as you can see, I've got this whiteboard behind me and we just talk and I write things down. So what happens during this process is we start taking things out of their brain. We get it out of using up space and bandwidth, and we start to put it externally so that they can look at it in a new way. And then we just, I mean, I, as you said, like, I listen, I ask a lot of questions. I ask to clarify something like, is it the more this or is it more this that you're really interested in? And we just keep going after, what do they want? Like, can we get to some clarity about what they really want? What does it mean to feel like you're doing well at your career? What does that mean for that person? What do you think it would feel or look like to feel more confident? We just try and put words to things. And it doesn't always have to be numbers, but sometimes there are numbers involved. If there are, great. Like, those can be a piece of a goal.
Right.
But again, it's sort of doggedly going after clarity about what someone wants really helps us start to figure out, like, I'm watching and I'm listening and it really helps me begin to figure out what lights them and also what's not working right now. Like the flip, what do they not want?
Right.
Maybe about their current situation. And so that pen to paper or pen to whiteboard is really valuable, as is trying to get someone else to understand what they're thinking. So it is work But it actually helps that, like, you know, I have worked with people who are in the biotech and medical industry, but commonly I'm also working with people who are in a separate industry. And the sheer act of having to explain their life, their work, how does it work, why are things the way they are, produces a lot of insights and kind of aha moments for people when they have someone listening and asking kind of questions to understand, questions to be curious about them. And so I find that is really helpful in producing clarity about what they want. And then the second thing we go after in that is we go after, okay, what is actually most important for getting that? Like, what are the lever points? And so that's another big meta topic that we like try to get clarity on.
I like the idea of when you were saying that, the first thing that popped, because we work in images. We don't work necessarily in words. You know, wife and I went to Aruba several years ago. I don't think of the word Aruba, I-R-U-B-A.
Right.
I think of the sand, the beaches, and the slide that she had required. Believe me, it's a wimpy slide, but it was a slide to go to the pool. And, you know, like having a drink or looking at the sunrise and all this stuff. And when you put that, the words on the whiteboard, and somebody sees that visually out of their mind, suddenly, and I'm sure you've seen this, suddenly their whole physical being changes sometimes. Sometimes they get, you know, like, ugh, or sometimes like, you know, wow.
And then they
realize, you know, you just listed a whole bunch of stuff and that was the one thing. I'm sure you've taken these courses and these classes, you know, where they, you know, I can't remember the name of it. You might remember it. The one where, you know, you got to remember who, you know, good points and your bad points, and that's who you are and all this stuff. And people write down like 30 things they don't like. But when you switch them over to what the things they like, there's like three. Because it's so easy for the mind to put down all the negative. You're talking about being hard on yourself, going, well, these are good ideas, but does everybody else think that way? Does somebody else? Is that written in a book somewhere? I need to get justification. And you really don't need justification. If it's something that, as you say, lights you up, then figure out, talk to you, and find out what it is and work it out. Because we only can go to a certain level in our life. And we need other people to help us go to the next glass ceiling or whatever words you want to use. And you open up those doors. Because when I was reading things about you and I was searching all over the internet and the interviews, you've done tons of interviews and you're always lit up with what you're doing because you love what you're doing. And when I kept reading it, like here, you know, she's got a PhD, an MD and all this, you know, and some people going, oh, well, you know, this is going to be very complicated. That doesn't necessarily mean to be that way. Just because you have a lot of education doesn't mean that, I mean, we're talking normally. It's not something that people can't relate to. You're not talking words that are so, you know, because people get nervous and they have these ideas in their head, which is perfectly legitimate. It's like talking to a lawyer, you know, and like, I'm not going to understand the word they're saying. And then you find out it's not as complicated as you think because they're telling you in the non-legal terms. And I like how you break that down. You're extracting that out of their mind and you're letting them relax. It's like when I used to go with the troubleshooting thing in the hospital, they're already stressed out. They don't need me to come in and go bop them on the head like the Three Stooges. I say, let's get a cup of coffee. A lot of times we left the hospital and got a cup of coffee somewhere. And sometimes we're out there for 2 hours. And we, you know, it's one of those things when you think, oh my God, it's going to be a long time. It's not that, it goes by really fast when you're engulfed in your mind and somebody's thinking about it and you've got a process and procedure. And that's what I love about talking to you and other people. They've got these process procedures and they're all a little bit different, but they have that really cool thing. I learned so much from talking to you. And it's like, okay, let me get back to a couple things I have not, maybe I did. Let's see. Oh, here. So how you already did some tools. So one of the things I wanted to say, and I wonder your point of view on this, people think working harder is working smarter. That's not true. Working 80 hours a week, it's not really going to get you. It's kind of like when you're on the highway and the person's driving 90 miles an hour, you get off the off ramp and they're sitting behind you.
Right.
You get there faster.
Yeah.
You know, so how do you feel about that? You know, working harder is not necessarily working smarter.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there are a number of reasons why we do it. It is very socially influenced. There's a lot of work, I think, and culturally, particularly in America, but that is sort of performative. Like, I need to look busy But another reason I think we do it is we want to cover the basis. Like, we want to say, I'm working on something uncertain, which means I don't exactly know if I'm going to get it. And so why would I not just do everything I can think of to make sure I get it? And I can tell you why maybe that, just an alternate perspective of what is the cost of, again, working really, really hard without putting some deliberate thought into what's actually most important. So this is like the other thing we cover in this onboarding session I do with people is really trying to get to, and a number of people come in wanting balance. So again, like they're like, I'm overworked. This isn't going to be sustainable. So we want to ask the question, what is actually most impactful? What gives me more impact for the time or resources I put into it than the other stuff? And the challenge is not that there's like stuff that's kind of like lame and then there's the really high potent stuff. It's actually that there's good stuff, great stuff, and then there's the most potent stuff you do. And I think that's what makes it difficult when you start to say, I don't want to work 80 hours a week, or I actually need to spend some of that time. Maybe I do need to work 80 hours a week, but some of that time actually needs to go to something else. How do I do that? And so I love this question of how do we distill and really look at what is giving you your impact and what's noise? And how do we stop doing even the great stuff that's just not as good? Obviously that's garbage and this stuff's good. It's like choosing between more of a nuance there. So, that's that process of distilling and really trying to understand the lever points is something that I work really hard with people on, because then when we start to help them build momentum, figure out how to do that stuff, they make a lot of progress versus saying, okay, well, we can help you make progress, but you need to add 10 hours of homework onto what you're already doing. Right. Like that just doesn't work. The accounting is not proper.
Right. Yeah, so I call it, it's my nerdy thing, I call it fulcruming, and it's balancing. It's balancing that act between the negative and the positive, however you define it as, whether it's two minds or how you feel or whatever's comfortable with each person is fine. And you just need to balance that. And when you realize, perfect word, noise. There's just so much noise going on. Another question just leading into it, I just marked it down. A silence time is really important to me. Now, the philosophy I have is very spiritual. It's all spiritual. So I do my prayer meditation in the morning. I do it in the afternoon. And then I really work on it in the evening because we're sleeping in a soup of thought. I don't want to sleep in a soup of negativity. So I really focus on, I ask some questions and I find out what I'm supposed to do, my discovering, awakening, transformation, all these different process procedures I do for myself. But it comes back to, I want to be in a silent state. Now, sometimes I listen to some nice, relaxing shaman type music. Sometimes I don't, but I'm not sitting in some posture, the yoga position. I can't sit that way anyway. I'm just sitting on the couch or I'm standing and I just give that my mind time to that noise level and just kind of like dampen it. So wait for this to go away. Cause it's like, you've heard of the Tao Te Ching. So Lao Tzu talks about waves a lot, water. And the more go against the waves, the more it pushes you back. So when you try to force to get rid of something or force to do something you think you should do, it pushes back on you and you never get anywhere. You get more frustrated and more noise is going. So people are like, well, how do you meditate? Well, everybody's different. I say, stop going against your noise. Just let the noise be. You can't get rid of the noise because if the noise is gone, I don't think you're on the planet Earth anymore. This is my grandma who lived to 99. She said, you're 6 feet under the ground. That's the only time you don't stop learning. So just let the noise be and have quiet. So how do you, because people say, well, I don't have enough silence time. I know I got to be on the phone. I got to do on this or whatever. How do you incorporate silence? Because I want your point of view on this. How do you do that with yourself to keep that silence? It's very important to have quiet time for yourself. Mm-hmm. How do you do this?
So I like that you pointed out it's going to be different for different people. And this is this wonderful example of where, like, if I'm coaching someone, we try and figure out what's going to make sense for them. I can use an example for myself. Like, I have certainly had quiet time while waiting in the grocery line, like stare down at the bottom rack of gum. Just stare down at the bottom rack of gum. Don't have to close your eyes. People start to think you're weird or they ask you if you're okay. And like, focus on your breathing. And that grocery line might be 5 or 10 minutes long, particularly if, you know, there's someone in front of you who is needing to do a bunch of different types of transactions. And it is both saves you from the aggravation that could stir up inside you, but it can be, and there's plenty of noise in a grocery store. So that's a sort of a silly example, but I would say my favorite quiet times, and they have kind of different purposes. Like, sometimes I'm writing. So like in the morning, I have a little bit of like contemplation time. It's usually the first thing I do. And the way I do it is I often sort of try and figure out, what is my perspective? Like, what did you wake up with? And sometimes like I get a ton of REM, and so I have lots of dreams. And sometimes you have something left over from a dream that was either good or bad, but, you know, positive or negative. But I often try and just put my finger on what is the default perspective I'm literally walking into this day with, so I can at least identify it. And for example, if it's like less than positive or less than what I would like to be going into the day with, I do a little bit of thinking about like what might be a different way to look at it, some shifting. I also often use some of that time to sort of put my brain on straight around like what is most important today. And because we live our lives one day at a time, like the now is what we can impact. And the point isn't that we shouldn't think strategically about the future. If there are things we think we want, we have to be working and building days that lead in a sequence towards that. But all we can really impact is today. And so I often think, what does building a good day look like today? And what's important usually includes some work. It also usually includes some exercise, which is maybe the third place that I really like to get my quiet time is right now I'm living in Wyoming and I can cross country ski. So this morning,
oh my God,
I got out early, you know, before the groomer was even out there doing that stuff, and just totally empty like farmland with cross country trail. And I just skied and I listened to my heartbeat and my breath. And that's a form of quiet time too. So
I don't think it's a silly thing they were staring down at the gum, because so this is going to sound just as weird, probably weirder. I look forward to cleaning the bathtub, cleaning That's the awesome. Toilets, doing some dusting, because it gives me time to think. I'll listen to an audiobook. I'll listen to music. I'll do some writing. I get more inspiration by that's my alone time. And like at a grocery store or wherever we're going, it's my alone time. I can make that alone time. I can stare at that piece of gum. I can stare at my shoe, because taking my time, my valuable time in life, and using that to get aggravated that I got to wait 10 minutes and flipping that around and going, okay, what can I get out of this? Maybe there's something I can learn from this. Not maybe for somebody else. Maybe there's somebody in front of me that is kind of looking at me and going, you have a striking up a conversation and this is the best friend you never thought you had, or the partner that you were looking, you don't know. And, you know, I always make jokes and silly remarks. And my goal when I go into, I always say barista, I'm not a coffee drinker, but if you go there and I meet somebody for a cup of coffee, or if you get on a plane and you see somebody's having a bad day, by their body language, you don't know what's going on with them. Mm-hmm. And we tend to get mad at them. And it's like, wait a minute, what am I doing? And I think back and I do something to make them smile, an honest thing, whatever comes to me. And suddenly they smile. And if it just helped them look, because I don't know, maybe they found out somebody got sick, somebody died, somebody lost it. There's a million things. And I don't, people are going to share this stuff and they shouldn't have to share it. But yeah, it just happens, and it could happen a minute ago or 10 days ago. And, you know, I've had people, and I'm not looking for a pat on the back, but some people are like, thank you for that. You made me laugh. That makes me feel good, because we all need that sometimes. I marked down a note about the cleaning, and because it is really important to, you know, like the swimming or your exercising, or you're stretching, or you're sitting and meditating, whatever that, how that, not everyone's going to be the same way. It's impossible. Now, there's no such thing as one size fits all. And I have a friend of mine, his name is Doug, and he likes to go out. He lives in California, real far out in some desert area. He just sits back there and has a cup of coffee in the morning. No noise. Looks at the mountains. Just relax. If that makes you good, if you like just, you know, I was joking with one of my students said, if you like going home at the end of the day and have a bologna sandwich on wheat toast with mustard and it makes you feel great and you can sleep well, have one every single day. I don't care, because what works for me doesn't work for you. It's not supposed to be, because, you know, when somebody does something to you, whether it's good or bad, intentional or unintentional, and you react to them, they're now in charge of you.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
We do this all the time. And I've done it. We've all done it. And I've learned through my belief system, it doesn't stop it, but it's a way, and you're giving tools. That's why I love about the stuff that I'm talking with you about. You're giving people tools. And let me go to the next one. I believe this, we might have touched on this earlier. Enjoying the journey, not the end result. When I went as an adult and got my MBA, and I enjoyed the journey, because I learned, like when I got my engineering degree when I was younger, you know, I was like, hurry up, get it done, hurry up, get it done.
Yeah.
And then they give you a piece of paper. Wait a minute, this is it? 4 years, what? What? And I didn't understand it. And when I got older and I did an MBA and I did it because I wanted to, and I had more fun doing it because I was doing it for myself. And I had more fun getting into it because I realized it's just a piece of paper, doesn't mean anything. And I brought life experience too, which is cool. How do you get it? Do you see that differently, or how do you see that? Because I believe, you know, because there's some theories, oh, you should enjoy the end result, not the journey. I don't agree. I think it's the joy of getting there. If you're miserable going on the way up, and, you know, health for wealth and wealth for health, if you're a miserable person on the way up, you'll be miserable when you get there. So how do you deal with that?
Well, I think some of the places this gets controversial, I don't know that enjoy the journey doesn't seem super controversial to me. I'm right there with you. But I think what happens sometimes is that there can be a conflict between, well, if we're just enjoying the journey, should we set goals? Should we articulate deliberately or intentionally what we want? And what is the role of setting goals? And people have very mixed experiences. Some people love goals, some people hate goals, SMART goals, this goals. Again, this is another area of performance where I think it's useful to let go of the exact trappings of exactly how you should do it and try and understand the inner workings of what's most important about it. And I am a firm believer of figure out a process that you trust, enjoy, or at least enjoy sort of the rewards of. Like, some people will start jogging and they'll be like, I never really loved jogging, but I know I can anticipate that I feel really good when I stop and I walk the 2 blocks back to my house. And that feeling I have in that moment is amazing. And I also logically know the other good things it's doing for me. And I enjoy knowing, feeling that confidence that I'm taking care of my health. You know, so it's, the point is, I think it's really important to, for these games, and many of which in life are long-term plays. They're compounding. They're not things you get done really quick. They're not sprints. They're things you have to do deliberately over time. That figuring out how to enjoy that journey is the difference between you actually continuing to do it and stopping and quitting. So then it raises this interesting question of like, okay, but then do we need goals? Like, maybe we just need a process and we need to focus only on process. And I think the key is you sort of need to be able to like frame shift back and forth between the two, because how, like, part of figuring out what might be a useful process is you have to say, well, what are the tracks like that go to the station I want? What station do you want to go to? You know, you can go get on any train, but that isn't a guarantee that it's going to take you to where you want to go.
Right.
And so this is where I think it's also really important to articulate, what is it kind of long term where you want to end up? And I will be honest, sometimes there was someone, I think it was a tennis star, who was like one of the bigs, you know, competitions, and was like, yeah, that felt good for about 3 minutes. Like, literally, I mean, this is like a pro athlete, superstar. And it's like, that felt really good for a hot second. And no, they wouldn't choose to trade it in, but that is not the thing that then will sustain them. And so this is why I do believe having that process be something that feeds you matters a lot. But that it doesn't mean having some of these milestones isn't really important. They also, incidentally, are things often that allow us to make more visible what we're working towards, what we've accomplished. And that does, in fact, matter as we're trying to, when we need other people to participate in what we're trying to accomplish. Like, so I think, anyways, there's interplay, there's tension. Both actually matter. It is not all one or the other. And I think these are the complexities of performance science that don't have to stay complex, that we can kind of break down and say, well, there's some usefulness in each, and here's probably what really matters about each, but not getting overly bogged down in, oh, if I want to elevate my performance, I have to do this, and I got to do this, and I need this morning routine, and like, I have to have SMART goals, but I also have to good process, and, you know, it can get to be a bit much.
Well, you don't want to get bogged down in these tedious little things.
Yes.
You know, I always refer to processes and procedures. I mean, it's a process of procedure how you brush your teeth, and a process of procedure to wash your hair, those of us that have hair. And it's, you don't want to get bogged down in it and learning from the being an engineer, because I was never a kind of engineer who, I was offered a job to, you know, the drawings and CAD. And you, as you could see, I couldn't sit still long enough to be able to do that. That's not me. I've got to be talking to people. I got to be talking to humans. And I wouldn't have given back anything in all the travels and the people that I met all over the world. I would never get, I'd never give it back. You know, I wouldn't go back and do it now in my life, but I loved it. I loved to travel. I loved to do this. But it was more the excitement of going to, I had more excitement going to a 7-hour trip to Europe because I never did it for the first time.
Yeah.
This is what I think. I'm thinking, ooh, I get to watch movies. I can't sleep on planes anyway. And my first trip was in, where was it? It wasn't Amsterdam. It was in, not directly in Amsterdam, but it was in Holland. And I went there by myself. And when my manager said, hey, you want to go to Holland? I go, Michigan? And he goes, no, you idiot, overseas. I was like, you know, and I had, it was a little uncomfortable, but it was comfortable enough with me knowing, I can't wait to do this. And when I got there and I was by myself, I realized that it wasn't as scary as you thought it was. It wasn't as disaster. What was the thing you say you go through 5 hours? What was the name of that again? You go through 5 hours of what?
Oh, it's, I mean, well, brutal focus, but it's my onboarding session.
No, but I, yeah. The whole thing, and I understand it because it's not brutal, like you're getting beat up or anything. It's kind of like a wake-up call going, we're going to spend some time on this, and we're going to dig deep into this. And I like the title, Brutal, you know, because it's, yeah, it's, and then people are going, well, what's that all about? The next thing you know, it's 5 hours later. And I just, you know, meeting.
And they did it.
I'm sorry?
And they did it. Five hours later. And they did it. And
yes.
You went to Holland.
Yeah.
And you were there. And you were like, okay, I'm doing this.
Yeah. And you learned. And then people's like, and then I had my first train ride between Holland and another city, and I was like, where's the train station? And it's all different. I mean, you know, it is very different going to the bathroom on a train and flushing the toilet and seeing that there is nothing but the outside. I felt like I was in a comedy routine or something. I flushed the toilet, I pushed it up. I'm like, what? Did I just see tracks? I did it again, and it went right out to the world. And this is probably the way they've been doing it for 1,000 years, right? But it's just interesting to see different places, different ways of doing things, different. I mean, we all do the same thing. And that's one thing that we talked earlier before the record button was, we're all the same. There really is not that much difference between anybody. We want the same thing. We want to be happy, want to have maybe a family, some friends, you know, a nice job, maybe a little money and stuff, and just do our stuff and be enjoying abundance. And it's just, you assist in finding that road and how we consciously communicate to the outside world, not the world to us. And I like what you do because you're getting into the brutal stuff. You're getting into that conversation, what's going on inside of you. It's not about Dr. Fowler. It's about you and marking those things down on the whiteboard and you getting fired up and you feel good as the coach, mm-hmm. as a person, seeing somebody light up with a word that lights them up. And yes. like, ah. And it's interesting to see that change. It's not much of a change. It's kind of like, you know, their whole body relaxes. They smile in the face, or they look at you direct in the eye, and that you see little redness, you know, from the blood rushing through their body. And like, they might not even know, but you're like, ah, you know, and it's just getting in touch with that. That's what I love talking to yourself and other people that I've interviewed, is because this is so important to be able to know your inner knowing. You're the only one who knows, and you bring that out in a very unique way and very pleasant. She's easy to talk to. Obviously, you've listened to her the entire time. She's very genuine. And, you know, it's just been an absolute pleasure talking to you. I want to thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you so much, Phil. Likewise, it's been a delight.
And you might be another permanent guest, so I'll have to invite you again, because there's so many other things we could touch on. But I will end it with this. Remember, to my conscious community, my audience, remember, it is more important to express your thinking thoughts and not the thoughts you are thinking. That is what is called conscious communication. See you next time.
Thanks for listening to Conscious Communication. If you enjoyed the show, please rate and recommend on Apple Podcasts, Overcast, or wherever you get your podcast. You can also get more great information at ConsciousCommunicationPodcast.com.